Today on the Grave Talks, the Wildwood Sanitarium. The Wildwood Sanitarium was set up around the turn of the century as a place for souls struggling with addiction or mental health problems. Decades ahead of its time, it would specialize in modern therapies of the day in small one-on-one settings. Shortly after its opening, the world would experience a tuberculosis outbreak and require its rooms to be used as a makeshift TB hospital. Little is known about what went on behind the walls of the building after this point, until recent times when the property was rescued and began to be rehabilitated. Today, we hear the ghost story of the Wildwood Sanitarium with paranormal investigator Matt Warner.
I actually spoke with the owner, Lori, the other day. I let her know. I said, hey, I'm going to be doing some interviews, and I'd like to shed some light on your property, and I want to give the correct history because I like to make sure people do the right history. There's nothing worse to me than that.
Yeah.
So, the property was purchased in 1903 by a Dr. John Henderson. This is about when the history that they've been able to find started. Mm-hmm. There was his tenants. The acting physician at the home was Dr. Carol Perry, and they were both osteopathic doctors, which was way ahead of its time. They believed in holistic healing and light years ahead of, where they were at the time otherwise.
Yeah.
So they had done some renovations, primarily in the basement, and they turned the basement into a bathhouse of sorts. And the residence itself, now you hear sanitarium, you think of this massive, large-scale building. It's a three-story home in a residential neighborhood that it didn't have the creepy gated archway. You wouldn't even know it was there. Mm-hmm. It's quite impressive. Because when we were driving, I was like, where is this place? We're in a neighborhood, and boom, there it was. So in the basement, the home, they had room for 10 residents. But they could also have outside people come in and get healing bath treatments and various different tubs and equipment. They had cold baths, hot baths. The one that freaks me out is electric battery baths, where it actually electrocute you while you're in the water, thinking that was a good thing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how anyone ever thought that was a good idea, honestly. But
it tingles. Yeah, that might be a little...
Of course, I had to lay in the bathtub when I was there. So let me lay in this bathtub, see if we can't conjure up anything. But
yeah,
so that was fun. They had a steam cabinet, light bath therapy cabinet. And the sanitarium itself actually opened in 1906, and they had three nurses on staff. So the head nurse her name was Bertha, and then the other two was Agnes and Sue, who were in training. The two doctors that worked there met each other in college in Kirksville, Missouri, and they dreamt of opening a sanitarium where people could come for a variety of reasons to cure drug, alcohol addiction, heal from non-contagious diseases, get mental help, or heal from an injury.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you hear the word sanitarium, you think these horrific things, lobotomies and everything. This was a nice place to go, which is also very unheard of these days,
I mean, would it almost be comparable to a recovery treatment center today, more so than like a what we think of sanatorium or sanitarium, where it's, this crazy place where people are just roaming somewhat free and they're all just kind of confined to this large, massive building? Is this more of like that, like what we think of today for the, like I said, like a drug treatment center?
That's what I would liken it to. Absolutely.
Okay.
It definitely seems more on the peaceful path versus, you watch American Horror Story Asylum. It's definitely not on that side of the spectrum. This is for the greater good. It kind of reminds me of Kellogg and his wacky milk therapies and all that he was doing back in the day in his hospital that he had too. It's more for greater good. I don't think there was anything, horrendous experiments going on that I heard of.
Sure. Sure. So what was the life of the place like? We know when it was built. We know, some of the people who were working there, and it was with good intent, and it wasn't some massive facility. It was really one-on-one care. Is this a place where just the average person who has an addiction or an issue can go to? Or because it is such, such centralized care and such one-on-one care, that this is really more of a of the day, you got to have a bit of money to afford getting to a place like this.
Well, unfortunately, what wound up happening is, you know, these two doctors living their dream of having the sanitarium. It was fairly short-lived because what happened in 1923, tuberculosis took over the country and the sanitarium was forced to open up as a TB clinic.
Okay.
Until antibiotics were discovered. So it really changed. Its whole allure changed, and then it became that, you know. So I'm not really 100% sure if it was what kind of people would be there, if it would be the common folk or the rich folk. It appeals to me. When we were there, we got the, you know, what information we got was that it was pretty much open for everybody.
Okay.
It wasn't the wealthy.
Yeah, it was a smaller facility that wasn't the scary type thing when you hear the word sanitarium. And then TB strikes, and then they kind of have to repurpose things to fit that need at that time. It's interesting because we're finally, not like it's a good thing, but we're learning in our country now that how things can be repurposed and reimaged and how to do them when things suddenly change, you know, restaurants being one of them. So essentially...
COVID sanitariums will happen next, right?
Exactly. By the time this airs, you may be 100% on the money, because this is going to be airing mid-September and we're recording this at the end of July, so who knows. It's that sort of a thing where those sort of things have happened in history. It's just not in anyone's recent memory because most folks from 1906 or that time period are no longer with us. So it goes to the TB hospital. What happens while it's the TB hospital, and how does it phase itself into its next thing as that sort of passes as antibiotics come into play?
See, there's not much history there that I was able to pull up. And speaking with the owner, strangely enough, both of the doctors passed away in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
One of them died of an enlarging of the heart. And one died at his office down the street. But there's not much history between there and after the TB. And the notes she gave me, she more or less touched upon the spirits that she's witnessed there and people have witnessed there and the experiences. But I really actually don't have that answer now. I feel like a bum.
I'm curious. I mean, so obviously this thing, it becomes a TB hospital. But after that, and it's still standing today, that's a big chunk of history. Does it continue to be used for anything at all? Is it just sitting there for literally 50 some years? Has it become a home? Just generally, do we know what happens with the structure up until present time between the TB hospital?
So the current owner, Lori, bought this location a few years ago. She was drawn to it. It was one of those things that she felt the pull. Went, was able to purchase it, and she is currently in the process of fundraising to put on a new roof, keep it open. It is open for paranormal investigations and day tours, and I'll tell you, being in that place, it has its own feel of energy. The third floor especially for me was full of energy. It's an incredible piece of history, like you mentioned, to be able to walk into something and the basement where the tubs were, there's still a couple tubs down there, and You walk through it and you can just feel, it's like stepping back in time. And I know she's got a GoFundMe up on their Wildwood Sanitarium Facebook page, trying to raise some funds. And there's always events running out there for that exact reason. But she wants to restore it and keep it open for paranormal investigation and scientific research, basically.
Sure. It's interesting. So when she took possession of it, when she bought it, what was it? What sort of state was it in?
It was really rough. It had sat abandoned for a long time. I forget the exact amount of time, but she told me it had been abandoned for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it does need a lot of work. It's going to need a lot of love, because when buildings were built 100, 125 years ago, they used much, much more quality items that they don't make anymore. And they don't do the detail that they used to do. So you have the scalloped shale slate roofs and things like that. You can't replicate that. So you have to have somebody make those or repurpose those. And it's a work of love, that's for sure. It's going to take a lot. There's a lot of brickwork that needs to be repointed and things like that.
Yeah. So,
it's a labor of...
It almost looks like, as I'm looking at the history at the same time, too, it almost looks like after the tuberculosis outbreak, unless I'm missing something, and we all are, it sat for quite a while. I mean, maybe as a home, maybe, I mean, there was probably some type of upkeep to it, but so it didn't completely get dilapidated. But I think its heyday was obviously prior to the tuberculosis, and then it kind of somewhat managed until its current incarnation.
I believe she had mentioned that it was used for apartments at one point for a short spell.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people would really want to live in there like that, but I know that it was, she did mention that.
Sure. I mean, it has that feel.
She has stayed there, obviously.
So what, when we look back at the history of the Wildwood Sanitarium, where, based on what you know, where do the ghost stories begin? Is it when she's taken it over and started really kind of using it to investigate, or did it have kind of urban legends and stuff surrounding it for years as it sat there as apartments and just kind of in somewhat disrepair?
See, that's a good question. That I didn't know of the place prior to her owning it.
Mm-hmm.
Just finally got out to go see it back in June when I was out in New York. And so I don't know if she went in to buy it with previous knowledge of its potential hauntings or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I could feel the energy in some of those rooms as well. And I know that there's something going on there in just the short time I spent there. And I actually had some friends that did an overnight there a couple of weeks ago, and I heard that it was pretty active for them as well.
What drove you to wanting to find out more about it? When did you first hear about it, and what made you go, I gotta visit this place?
Well, I was invited by a couple of friends of mine to go investigate the Hinsdale House out in Hinsdale, New York.
Sure.
And she had mentioned to me, she said, oh, if you guys are up early enough, we're going to check out Wildwood beforehand because it's only about a half an hour away.
Mm-hmm.
If you with, I said, absolutely. I want to see. I'm trying to check off bucket list places for myself, and any haunt is okay with me. I want to check it out. I want to support, help these places stay afloat. And it's an 8-hour drive for me, so it's not every day I'm going to drive all the way out there to go to a place. If I can knock off 2 for 1, I'm definitely going to do it.
Sure.
That's kind of how it got me out there.
As you went into the doors of this place for the first time, what's going through your mind? What are you feeling?
So when I walk into any place, I try to, it's going to sound bizarre, I try to like calm down and open up, just open up my senses and see what I feel. And I walked in and I could feel like the age of the place. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, the smells, like when you walk into an antique shop, it smells old. That's like my favorite smell. When you walk in, I smell history, you know?
And yes.
Walk around. And one of the cool things that they do there that some places do is all the investigators that come sign their name on the trim of the doors and things like that. So it was really fun to look and say, oh, I know that guy. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm putting my name right here and, you know, helping to preserve it. But walking around, I like to walk around places on my own and kind of vibe out before I get histories of them. And
mm-hmm.
I walked around the house by myself while she was doing some of the tours. And some of the rooms that she mentioned had more energy than others I had already picked up on. So that's how I kind of corroborate things for myself.
Yeah.
Like when I go on an investigation with my team, I have a researcher that does all the research, and I tell her I don't want to know anything until after, because that way if I pick up on anything, I can say, this is what I got. And then she can either say, oh yeah, that's exactly it, or you're way off.
Sure.
It makes it a more open forum, I guess.
Yeah. So what are you finding as you are going through the place? Because then I want to talk about what she's experienced as well as what you've heard.
So the one room in there that stood out the most to me was on the second floor, and it was a kid's room. It was it's all painted blue. It's a very in-your-face blue, not subtle whatsoever. And I walked through the doorway, and it just felt heavy. The energy in the air felt kind of like it was weighing down on you, almost like that underwater pressure feel. That's kind of how my abilities work. So I just felt off in there, and I was like, okay, there's something in here. And then she was telling us later that that's the little boy's room, and that they see the spirit of Tommy in there all the time. That's his name that somebody got at one point or another. So that was Tommy's room, something I felt prior to her telling me anything about it. And then on the third floor, the whole third floor had that heaviness to it. And they had I don't want to call it an operating room, but they had a little doctor's office on the third floor that just felt different than all the other rooms. It was an energy, but it wasn't heavy. It was just different,
mm-hmm.
for lack of descriptive term, unfortunately. But yeah, the first floor felt totally fine. The basement, surprisingly enough, felt fine. I don't really care for basements, but I'm usually drawn to them because that's usually where you find stuff. But that one was fine. And there's a room at the Wildwood that is filled with dolls. And most people have this huge fear and hatred of dolls. They don't bother me anymore. I've gotten used to it. I have quite a few myself, but I didn't feel anything in that room either. And I think a lot of times that fear of dolls plays off people and they just assume that room's creepy. So
sure.
I didn't get anything in there, but the little boys room definitely for me, and the third floor itself. And I poked my head up through into the attic, but there's pigeons up there. The pigeons scared the hell out of me, and I kind of jumped back because they were right there. But I wasn't squeezing up into the attic after I saw those.
What do we know historically about the location as far as who might likely be there? I mean, when we're you know, obviously there's hauntings where the folks who are haunting it really never were there in life. But there's many where it is people who were there in life for whatever reasons. Was there any tragedy? Was there any just death or by natural causes, things of that nature on the property over the years?
I'm trying to remember if there was any, I'm trying to think here if there was any, I don't believe there was any confirmed deaths at that location.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember if I heard anything of that or not.
Which is then very interesting, because then you start to look at, well, then who is here and why are they here? And quite often what I think we go to is people, they return to places that in life they had a positive experience with. It's not necessarily wanting to go back and seek out trauma. Oftentimes when we see the trauma type ghosts, they're there because they can't get out of there. So if they're there for a reason that seems to be relatively harmless, it was likely, you know, it was a place of employment. It may be a place of, you know, of great joy of being able to help people. When you talked about like Bertha and Agnes and Sue, maybe it was a positive type experience of this is what my lot in life was. I was helping people along. But you tell me, who are the spirits that haunt this sanitarium?
I completely agree with a lot of what you just said there in terms of what it could be, because you just don't know. I was looking through some other notes that I had in a different page, and it was after the TB hospital, it was apartments that no one ever wanted to stay in. So they did not stay rented very long because of whatever was there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, so I'm looking at some of the claims. There are two regular spirits that are seen are a little girl and Tommy, who's a little boy, and some, you know, other ones pop up. There are two cemeteries that are very close to the house. And there are some people that believe there may be a portal actually in this home, which if there is a portal there would explain all of it. You know, if you want to get into that level of belief, I believe that there are portals. Some people don't. So that could very well be it. And the land itself, I believe, was Native American land at one point, like most of this country. Mm-hmm. So that could also have something to do with it, especially if there's a portal there. We really have no idea. And there's a lot of reports of shadow people, too.
Because when you talk about the TB hospital, and there just isn't the records that go along with it, and that's true across the country in many cases, as far as the records of many TB hospitals, other than it was a TB hospital, and then you almost have to assume at some point there probably was death, but maybe not as well documented as it should be. That also kind of makes you wonder then about the kids, because in its original incarnation, almost as like a recovery type facility, there probably wouldn't be little kids there.
Exactly. I agree with you. And one thought that I have is perhaps these children were kids of the doctors.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Again, with the same, like you said, with the records, you look at massive place like Waverly Hills, they can't even confirm how many people died there.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times they just brush these records off because they didn't want the public to know. Very similar to the nonsense we're dealing with right now with our own pandemic.
Exactly.
Hiding everything.
You don't want the numbers. I mean, the numbers scare people, and rightfully so. And if you have a property, if you have a building that, you know, granted we're talking, you know, roughly 100 years ago, still, people play by the same rules to a certain extent. You know, people aren't going to want to go to a medical facility or a rehabilitation facility or live on a property if the intent is, well, after this, we'll make it into apartments or sell it as a house, knowing full well that a lot of people died there. that same reaction was true 100 years ago as it would be today. So and if there's nobody sitting there holding your hand saying you have to report this and we can track this, you could probably get away with a lot of underreporting of information than is in fact reality. Let's talk about the portal angle here a little bit, because portals are an interesting thing, and I it's not that I disbelieve in them. It's not that I, in fact, I would say I do believe in them. I just want to understand more about them. It's a term that gets thrown around there sometimes almost as easily as demon. And it's like, well, let's dig into this a bit more. And, you know, folks like yourself, when they bring it up, it piques my interest, because it's like, it's not just like anybody who's just like, oh, it's a portal, you know, and I was selling phones last week and decided to become a ghost hunter. It's you got some experience behind you to say that it can be taken with a lot more gravity than just, you know, Joe Blow who hunts ghosts. So the portal idea, let's talk about that for a moment. Number one, portals, how are they created, or are they just there? Is this something where a building, because of the activity that occurred in it in life, has essentially developed a portal because of death, because of whatever it may be? Or is it a portal something that's always there? Doesn't matter what's sitting on that piece of land, of that geographic coordinate, there's a portal there. You can put a Walmart on it, you can put a house on it, you can put a barn on it. The portal's going to be there. How does that work?
So I'm going to go, I mean, I'm agreeing with you all day today on everything, because I'm in the same, you know, mindset with the portals. I do think that they exist. I don't think that people throw that word around as much as they do, just like demons. Mm-hmm. My belief system on portals, I do believe they're a thing. I think that they are, it's going to sound bizarre, I think it's an interdimensional thing just between the spirit world and our world that we're not meant to see. I think they're all over the place. They're definitely pre-existent. So you could build a Walmart over it, and that would explain half the people that are in the damn place.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely think that they're there. They can't be opened or closed. I think they're going to be there regardless. I definitely think there's ways that you can kind of protect against what comes through, depending on your belief system and how you go about putting protection around yourself and your property and everything. But I think they're always there. I think that they're more plentiful than we would ever know. And I also believe mirrors can be portals. That's why I don't really like having mirrors facing my bed and all that stuff. That's something I don't really care for, because I don't want that to wake up in the middle of the night and see something staring back at me that isn't me.
Sure. Ken, let's say a mirror. I mean, a mirror is something that's like an inanimate object that can be moved around physically. You know, it's like portal mobile, you know. So it's what I'm kind of asking is, are there two different types of portals where it could be something that is created by a human being, somehow a mirror is given extra abilities or something because of where it was involved, then can become a portal? Or can just any mirror at any time become a portal? Or is it more so the mirror has to be in the vicinity of what would be a portal that is just linked to the earth, linked to that geographic spot, for it to be active?
See, I think a portal, in terms of a mirror style portal, I think that would have to be created. I think you would have to put your energy into it.
Mm-hmm.
Just recently did my first scrying session. So scrying is when you use a mirror and use it for divination. And divination is a way to contact spirits and try to see the future, the past, whatever you're trying to put out there. Use your psychic abilities and try to tap into the guides on the other side of this mirror.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in that. I had some interesting experiences doing that. Same thing. I didn't really believe in it prior, but after doing it, I said, all right, there is some power behind this. We as humans are far more powerful than we give ourselves credit for. We are, if we could just not be distracted by day-to-day life, we could tap into the inner deepest parts of our brains. We could do some amazing things. And with these mirrors, I definitely believe that there's more to them if you give them that power. And I think that they could be anywhere you want. If you wanted to open up that line of communication, it's similar to using other ghost hunting equipment and just asking for responses. You're opening yourself up because you want to hear from them.
Would a mirror that is essentially you're choosing to make that a object or a vessel for something to come through. You're creating a portal yourself. Would that be less powerful or a smaller door? I guess I'm just kind of speaking in as layman terms as I can about this, because that's where I'm coming from. Is it a smaller door? Less things are going to be able to get through that homemade portal versus a one that is attached to the land?
I think they're equal.
Really?
I don't think you could have something the size of a quarter or the size of a basketball, and you're going to get the same thing if it wants to come through.
Tell me about your experience there. You said it was a scrying session. Is that correct?
Yes. So how scrying works, there's a few different methods. You can do water scrying, flame scrying. I did a mirror scrying. So with mirror scrying, you're supposed to use a black mirror, which is essentially a mirror that's been painted black on the backside, so the reflection is cut down to near nothing.
Okay.
And what I did was I turned off lights. You put a candle on either side of the mirror so you have some light source so that you can actually see into the mirror. Mm-hmm. Depending on what you're trying to do, whether you want to see past, present, future, you want to see things about money, you would burn green candles. If you want to know about love, you'd burn red or pink candles, white candles for health, all that good stuff. There's a lot that goes into it. But they have the candles burning, and you just stare, not at the mirror, you almost want to stare through the mirror. So you sit across from it. Basically, I was staring through it. At first, I see my reflection, and then as you adjust your eyes, the reflection disappears. I saw my reflection looking back at me at one point in time, and my head was shaking back and forth when it wasn't in real life, which was kind of bizarre, and I was like, all right, this is different. And then as I got deeper in, asking questions, you know, simple questions like, if I'm trying to figure out the future, you know, what is in my future? Is anyone in here that wants to chat with me? I'd love to see my spirit guides. I saw the outline of a younger woman, probably in her 20s, with shoulder-length hair. Just the whole outline, it kind of flashed at the mirror at me and went away. I also saw the outline of a bald man, older. He appeared in the mirror. And then I also saw a misty purple shape that was dancing. It looked like it was doing like a ballroom dance in the mirror. And I'll tell you, I did this for about 10 or 15 minutes. I stopped and I had absolutely no energy left. My emotions were all over the place. It took all kinds of stuff for me, and it was the strangest experience because I didn't expect any of that. I didn't know what would come with it because I was new to it, but quite the experience, and definitely something I'm going to practice with because I think it's a very important tool that we can use to further our experiences and also to further our research.
When you went into this experience, do you have to go into it believing that it will work, or did you go into it with the attitude of maybe it'll work? I'm not sure. I'm open. This could be a bunch of BS. It could be real. Because obviously a lot of things we talk about here, it comes down to a belief system. And the only way that the system works and activity occurs in many cases is if you subscribe to it. So you going into this, not ever having experience about it, attitude-wise, did you go into this going, yeah, I think this could be a thing? What was your mindset?
So I'll tell you, I myself, in terms of pretty much everything in life, I'm a skeptical believer.
Sure.
I believe everything that's happened to me. I don't have to prove myself, but you certainly do. Mm-hmm. So I had a friend of mine who's done this a few times, and I did it with him, you know, via remote on Facebook Live. And so I was like, yeah, you know, it probably will work. And I kind of listened to myself. I said, all right, you know, I didn't believe in psychic abilities a few years ago, and here I am now having these experiences myself.
Yeah.
So anything is possible, and I do believe that if you put that belief out there, that you're going to be more in tune with it. So I went into it. I said, this is going to work. I'm going to have these experiences. I'm going to open myself up, completely open-minded for anything that will happen. And I definitely think that helped.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a skeptic person that didn't believe it, it's not going to work for them because they're going to just close that off. It's like a third eye type of thing. You have to really tap into a different level of your subconscious to get this to work. And it's all new to me, but I'm learning as I go. And I definitely believe in it.
So what was your reaction when you're sitting there and you go into this with an open mind, which is great because so you don't necessarily have to have proof that this is there or this is a thing. You just have to go into it accepting this could happen and have the open mind. When you had the experience and you're sitting there and you're noticing you have your head is shaking and your head is not, in fact, shaking on the side that is not the mirror. And then eventually you see the outline of the woman in the mirror and the man and the dancing and all that. How are you reacting? Are you calm? Are you in a trance almost like state? Not that you couldn't break it, but you're just kind of engrossed and you don't want to break that stare, so to speak, so you don't miss these things. Are you reacting? What's going through your mind?
That's pretty much exactly it. It's a form of channeling, and okay. you kind of just zone out.
Yeah.
And I was trying not to blink, and I didn't blink for quite some time because I was staring at it. And while this was going on, anything I saw, I was saying to the microphone so people on Facebook knew what I was seeing. Mm-hmm. And I stared as long as I could stare. And then it's like when we go investigating and the batteries in your camera drain. As an empath and, now learning to be a psychic, they take the energy out of humans just the same as they do out of batteries. Most people don't notice it, but I get drained so fast now that that's exactly what happened. I put all that energy into manifesting this and it happened. And I had people, I looked at the computer and they're like, you need to stop. You don't look well. And I looked at myself in the computer. I was like, oh my Lord, I look like I haven't slept in 3 days. And I said, all right, I'm going to stop for now. So I had to get up and I walked out to the kitchen to get a drink. As I walked through the doorway from my living room to my kitchen, it felt like I walked through a waterfall, all this pressure. And whatever I had been conjuring between that and the activity I have in my home regularly, it was all concentrated right there. So I don't know if that was where all my energy went and something was using it to manifest. I have no idea. But it definitely took everything out of me. And then I went back and did it again, and it wasn't as successful the second time.
It's not a foolproof thing where every time you go into it that it's going to work. What goes through my mind is walking through a shopping center like circa 1992, and in the center aisle there were all of those electronically developed pieces of art. I called them dot pictures. I don't know what the technical name was, but you would stare at them and people would just be standing there staring at them, and then suddenly like a dinosaur would kind of pop out at you and you'd see it, but you had to sit there and relax your eyes. Obviously that's not paranormal, but
I remember those. Those never worked for me. I used to get so frustrated looking at those. They work for everybody but me.
I know.
I can't see it.
I've had it like work one or two times in my entire life. My dad could just like walk through the mall and be like, yeah, there's a dinosaur there. There's a car there. And it's like, how the hell are you seeing this? And eventually I saw him once or twice and it was pretty cool, but it's just, it's not easy for me either. That's where we're going to pause part one of our conversation with paranormal investigator Matt Warner about the Wildwood Sanitarium. In part two of our conversation, we're going to ask, are there any dangers involved in using a mirror to communicate with the dead? If a portal is created, can it ever be closed? When Matt said he did not believe in psychic abilities just a few years ago, what changed his opinion? And can someone learn to be psychic? And is Matt ever concerned that he's being befriended by an entity that is not who or what it appears to be? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.